Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, Buzzkillers, here we are, post-election day, post-election week on Professor Buzzkill here in the United States. Very fortunately and very kindly, because she was willing to come on the show, we were talking to Dr. Terry Finneman, who's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. And more importantly, for our purposes, she's written a great book called Press Portrayals of Women Politicians from the 1870s to the 2000s, From the Lunatic Woodhull to the Polarizing Palin. Thank you for coming on the show, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an exciting time because, of course, as everyone knows, the election has just happened, and we have another woman candidate on the national ballot. But it seems to me what's so interesting about your book is not only will Buzzkillers not know that so many women have run for national office for over a century, but they've been treated in very different ways by the press, and the ways they've been treated by the press tell us not only about the context of the times they're in, but about the way gender is used in the press and the way politics and femininity are used. It's absolutely fascinating. And let me ask you first, what made you decide to choose this topic, but also these case studies, these individual women case studies that you chose?
So I am a former political reporter. I spent most of my career working in North Dakota for the Fargo Forum. And I spent a little bit of time working for ABC News in Washington, D.C. And so when I was working on my dissertation, I knew that I was interested in studying media and politics.
Yeah.
And what got me on this topic in particular is I was sitting in one of my PhD classes and we watched a video, and it was a mashup of sexist, disgusting language from cable broadcasters, and not just men, but also women, and not just Fox, but also MSNBC. And it made me start thinking about how we hear this kind of language all the time, and unfortunately, we're used to it by now. But when you see it mashed up, those clips, one after another, you see how much of a problem it really is. And so that is the whole point of my book, which looks at newspaper coverage to show how significant of an issue this is. I looked at over 1,300 articles in the time periods that I looked at throughout my whole book. And you just see these same themes coming up again and again. And so I wrote this book to come out before the 2016 election.
Right.
To take a look at how is it possible that we may have our first woman president, and let's take a look at who came before her and what they had to endure to make this possible. Now, of course, we still don't have our first woman president.
That's right, yeah.
But we're now at a point where it is much more likely, and it is so important for people to respect and understand their history of how we got to where we are, and to give respect to those people who made it possible. So as far as why I chose the women that I did, that was a little bit of a balancing act.
Yeah.
It was pretty easy to start with Victoria Woodhull, who virtually no one has heard of. And that's the whole point of a lot of the research that I do and my podcast, Journalism History, is to share these stories of these unknown people who have been erased from history. And that's a whole nother discussion, right, about who we include in history and who we exclude. And so no one has heard of her, even though she was the first woman to run for president in 1872. And so that was a pretty easy starting point. From there, the other women that I picked are about 40 to 50 years apart. I wanted pretty consistent time frames in between women to be able to jump at consistent periods across history to see what it had changed. These women also come from different periods of feminism to see how differences in gender views at the time impacted their coverage. And most of them are more conservative type of women, although certainly Victoria Woodhull was very liberal. But I do touch on briefly coverage of Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi. And really, overall, the theme of the book is that this is not a partisan issue. This affects both political parties, women in both parties face the same kind of cultural sexism. And my book is trying to call attention to this in order to promote change.
Right. Well, that's obviously so important. And it has been so important for, as you say, at least since the Civil War and maybe before that. Let's look at Victoria Woodhull first. Can you tell the Buzzkillers who she was, how she came to be so prominent politically, and of course, about her presidential run?
Victoria Woodhull is so fascinating. And I think, well, first of all, you know, since nobody knows that she exists, they probably assume that she was some no-name third-party candidate. And that's not true at all. Yeah. She was extremely well-known by the public of her day, which I'll get to. But Victoria Woodhull grew up in Ohio. Some may use the term on the wrong side of the tracks. Her father was not successful in business, and yet he went around saying that the family's rightful place in the world had been taken from them. Oh. And so when you're a child and you hear one of your parents acting yeah. like that, obviously you're probably going to grow up with a little bit of a chip on your shoulder, right? And have that kind of extra motivation to prove to the world that you deserve your place in society. And so she came from a, you know, larger kind of family, as most people did back then, that didn't have a lot of money. And so she and her sister, Tenny, worked as clairvoyants, as spiritualists, basically, yeah. During this time to earn some money, which was, you know, not all that uncommon, even though we may think it's a little odd now. And so the most pivotal moment that came in her life that also helped spur her to her later time is when she was about 14 years old, she became very sick. And Dr. Woodhull came to treat her, mm-hmm. who was, you know, much, much, much older than she was. But as was common during the time, you know, you want to marry off your female children as soon as possible. So then someone else has the financial burden. So by the time that she was 15, she was married to a man who turned out to not be a doctor, but who was a drunk and a womanizer. Oh. So imagine, I tell, you know, some of my students, imagine that you are like 16 years old and you are married to someone who's not at all who you thought they were, who is significantly older than you. And now you have a baby. And so with this tough start to her life, Victoria realizes just how unfair American culture is, where it is deemed perfectly fine for men to be having affairs with other women and running around, but yet women had no rights, essentially, for divorce or to leave these unhappy situations. And so this ended up playing a pretty significant role in her later position for free love.
Yeah.
Now, free love is controversial even nowadays, right? So you can only imagine how controversial it was back then. But these early experiences led her to realize that, you know, the government should not be controlling people's personal lives, and I should be able to love whoever I want, however long I want, and whenever I want. So that ended up being a pretty significant part of her platform later. But what ended up jolting her to prominence is she would eventually, you know, controversially for the time, end up getting divorced. She married a new man whose name was Colonel Blood, mm-hmm. which is kind of like a Clue-like name,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
For people familiar with the board game, who was a Civil War veteran. And she and Tenny had been continuing to do their spiritualism type of work. But states were starting to clamp down on that as being, you know, bogus. And so she and Tenny ended up in New York. And they ended up doing work for Cornelius Vanderbilt,
oh, yeah,
who
him.
Did believe in these things.
Yeah.
The famous Cornelius Vanderbilt and the very beautiful Tenny and Cornelius Vanderbilt. There's rumors that they may have had a relationship of sorts. You never know. And so they got in with Vanderbilt. And Vanderbilt gave Victoria Woodhull advice on how to play the stock market, and she made a lot of money. And so she ended up being the first woman to have a firm on Wall Street.
Wow.
And that attracted a significant amount of press attention.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, I also studied press coverage of the suffrage movement. At this time, you see the suffrage movement amping up again in the time after the Civil War, trying to convince Congress to give women the right to vote at the same time that they were giving black men the right to
yeah.
vote. And Victoria Woodhull was very intrigued by this, this women's rights movement, and she ended up getting involved with it. And so she was right there with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and worked her way up in prominence in the suffrage movement. She decided to run for president. She and Tenney started their own newspaper. Uh-huh. Not the first woman in this country to start their own newspaper, but definitely a pioneer in that field. And Victoria Woodhull is also believed to be the first woman to testify to Congress, trying to convince them to give women the right to vote. So as I said, this is not just some no-name third-party candidate. She was known by Vanderbilt. She was working with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So she was very well known to the people of her day.
And so then how does she run for president? What party does she, you know, what ticket does she lead? That sort of thing.
Yeah, she ends up on the Equal Rights Party. Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass was her running mm-hmm. mate. He did not agree to be her running mate, but that's how it all worked out. What's also interesting to point out is that there are no ballots, so to speak, with her name on them, because she actually was not constitutionally old enough to run for office.
Oh, okay.
She was 34 at the time, but she was running anyway. And, you know, she was advocating for... just a lot of basic things, you know, things kind of related to minimum wage and fair treatment of workers and those kinds of things back then. And so she ends up running. A fascinating story, though, is, again, she was just extremely irritated with a lot of things, which make a lot of sense. For one, she was irritated with other women. And you see this throughout the suffrage movement as well. When I give talks about suffrage, people always tend to assume that men were the biggest problem. And believe me, men were a big part of the problem, especially Congress, which sat for four decades
right.
on a women's voting rights bill before they decided to act on it, which is revolting. But a big, big part of the problem was other women.
Right.
There was an anti-suffrage movement against the expansion of their own rights. And there were a lot of women who were very, very nasty to Victoria Woodhull. And Susan B. Anthony also was not a fan of Victoria Woodhull. They ended up having a big falling out because Susan B. Anthony thought that Victoria Woodhull was just too liberal and starting to do damage to their cause. And so they had a big falling out. When you look at the writings of the time, Victoria Woodhull is left out of suffrage history.
Yeah.
So again, even other women are leaving her out, even though she played a prominent role and is a pioneer in politics for women. So those fallings out were happening, and she was very controversial. We can talk in a second about what kind of press coverage she got. But what's also interesting about her story is she used her newspaper to expose some of the hypocrisy of major male figures at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she told them, you'll either support my campaign or I'm going to expose that you are having affairs with other women and doing bad things. And they didn't, they thought she was bluffing. Oh, she wasn't bluffing. So she used her newspaper and exposed these men. People at the time thought that, it was completely outrageous. She ended up being arrested for basically publishing indecent material and then spent Election Day in jail, so she couldn't even try to vote for herself.
Right. Well, how did the party sort of fare? I mean, obviously it's a third party. Obviously they don't have the machinery or as much of the money behind them as the other parties do. What happens? Do they gain very many votes?
No, they didn't, because she wasn't even on the ballots. She wasn't even included.
On most ballots, okay.
As I said, she wasn't even old enough constitutionally to be on the ballot in the first place. And so there's really no record. And I mean, she was running against, think about this, she was running against technically Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah,
I mean, nobody is going to be a war hero during this time, right? I mean, and Horace Greeley, even a prominent newspaper publisher at this time. So, I mean, the party essentially went nowhere.
But then how did the press treat her, which is, of course, the focus of your book?
Right. So here's an example. This article ran in Arizona. The chapter name of Victoria Woodhull in my book is Media Vilification mm-hmm. of Victoria Woodhull. Mm-hmm. And we're going to come back to that because we see that with Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin in more recent times. But as an example, this is an article that ran in Arizona. Her connection with a movement damns that movement. She may be mad, but she is impure in thought and depraved in expression. Her ideas are not merely preposterous. They are revoltingly indecent and nasty.
Wow, that's an actual quote, too.
Yeah, that's an actual story. Yeah, yeah.
Does it continue that way through the whole campaign? Does she get any positive coverage at all, or even any reasonable coverage of what she's actually saying?
Yeah, she did get some positive coverage. I believe that it was a newspaper in Boston who gave her, you know, strong kudos for coming out with some important issues, right? Because, and actually talking about issues in the first place, right? And not just running on, you know, I'm a war hero, you know, so I'm great, right? But she was really talking and going into detail on a lot of different issues, which the paper was like, wow, this is kind of amazing for a woman to do this. But I mean, overall, it really was this vilification. Some other comments is she was referred to as the satanic ticket.
Oh my goodness.
Again, we've also in more recent times heard Hillary Clinton referred to in satanic terms.
Yeah.
So all of this kind of language really started in 1872 and still continues today. And, you know, after she published that controversial newspaper with findings that I believe to have been true, she was described as a fit subject for a lunatic asylum.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the kind of framing that the first woman who ran for president received in the press. And we still see the implications of that now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And we'd like to get to Hillary Clinton's certainly Kamala Harris after the break. But it's not just president. You look at Jeanette Rankin, for instance, the first woman elected to Congress, which, after all, even though you're elected from a district, is a national office. How does she begin her career to get to that stage?
Yeah, so it's fascinating to look at the similarities and differences in Victoria Woodhull and Jeanette Rankin's situations. So unlike Victoria Woodhull, Jeanette Rankin was born into a very prominent, wealthy Republican family.
Yeah.
That was well known in the state. You know, she went to college, but like Victoria Woodhull, Jeanette Rankin got involved with the suffrage movement and was close with the leaders. So Carrie Chapman Catt by now was the leader of the suffrage movement. And Jeanette Rankin was very active like Victoria was. Jeanette traveled around the country to Washington State, of course, Montana, to New York, because at that time suffragists were going with a state by state strategy because they were getting nowhere with the men in Congress.
Sure, sure.
And so they were trying to convince individual states to give women the right to vote. So Jeanette was extremely prominent in that regard. And what helped her is she was extremely well known in Montana then because she was in the halls of the Capitol doing lobbying. People knew who she was. So that gave her a significant advantage. Another key difference in their media coverage is that journalism has shifted by this time. So in the 1870s, you still have a very kind of partisan and sensational. You really don't have quite the yellow journalism era, but you have still kind of the penny press era where you have more sensational type of headlines and it's still very partisan. By the 1900s, you see journalism shifting and wanting to become more of a profession. And as a result, they're trying to form more standards of what it means to be a journalist, which means they're moving into more of a period of objectivity. Now, that's a whole nother discussion because objectivity has had different definitions throughout history, even though it's the same word. But you see a shift in journalism where it's not quite as nasty as it was before. So that ends up playing a pretty helpful role with Jeanette Rankin.
But she does get elected to Congress.
Yes.
So that's significant.
Yes, it is. But she also had some location on her side. It is not a surprise that it is Montana is the first state to send a woman to Congress for a few reasons. The West at this time, and in the few decades prior, had really touted itself as a progressive place, right? They were trying to attract people from the East to come out and live in the West, to populate the West, for women to come out there and marry men who were out in the West,
sure.
to help establish these communities from the ground up, right? So you have a little bit of a difference in gender norms and in politics going on at this time, where you are having this progressive movement that is happening in the early 1900s. Also, because of the huge population influx in Montana, Jeanette Rankin didn't have to run against an incumbent because Montana gained another seat in the House.
Oh, okay.
So she would go around and say, vote for the incumbent and then vote for me. So she did not have that incumbent man barrier that she had to go by. She was also an incredibly savvy politician. She was driving all around the state. She worked hard to get elected and to visit with people and to campaign. Again, she already had that name recognition from her time lobbying for suffrage. And then her next savvy move, which also has underlying sexism in it, which is a whole nother discussion, but she would tell people, we have so many men in Congress. There is no one there to talk for the children. Who is going to speak for the children?
Right.
Which was very savvy of her, but it also raises questions of, if we have problems with people using gender against women, should women really be using their gender to try to, you know, promote their cause, right? Kind of reverse sexism, so to speak. But it ended up being a very effective strategy. She got elected. Now, let's take a look at some of her coverage and note the differences with Victoria Woodhull. So this chapter is called Media Legitimization of Jeanette Rankin.
Oh, okay.
And like Victoria Woodhull, they focused on her ties to the suffrage movement.
Right.
And they focused, you know, on her politics and her personal traits. But for the first time, you see the press writing about she would be the first woman elected to Congress. Like, this is interesting, right? Yeah. Nobody wrote that Victoria Woodhull would be the first woman president. Like, that did not even cross their mind. Like, that did not come up at all, right? And so this interest in, wow, this would be kind of monumental and kind of cool. But here's a problem. You see, which continues today, an emphasis on women politicians' appearance show up already in 1916 with Jeanette Rankin. And so there is an entire article, and I believe that there were multiple ones that I read on this, just about the color of her hair.
Yeah. Yeah.
And her hair in general and her appearance. So this article says, if she's elected to Congress, she will improve that body, for she's said to be tall with a wealth of red hair. Even when good, Congress is not beautiful and needs adornment.
Yeah.
This is an actual story that ran in a newspaper about a woman politician.
Yeah. That's quite shocking. I mean, they don't ever ask for just lean, muscular, Herculean men in Congress. This is a good place for us to take a little break, and we have a special kind of break for you buskers out there, because we're going to talk about, in that break, Dr. Finneman's excellent podcast called Journalism History. So we'll be back in a minute.
Welcome to Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. Authors, journalists, and historians take you behind the scenes of media coverage surrounding landmark people and events. Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War Press. The history of Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus. The bombing of the LA Times in 1910. Ernie Pyle and war journalism. Walter Cronkite and That's the Way It Is. The real story of the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And the Stonewall Riots. And then there's the stories you were never told. The Fly and Jenny comic strip and its influence on women. Yankee reporters and their Southern secrets. A made-for-television tunnel escape. And just who was the Antichrist of American advertising? Find out these stories and more at journalism-history.org/podcast and wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, we're back, Buzzkillers, with Dr. Terry Finneman, who's here to talk to us about press portrayals of women politicians from the 1870s to the 2000s. Professor, before we left, you were talking about not only the first successful woman to run for a national office, Jeanette Rankin, but of course the first woman to run for president, and how the press treatment of those women was so, shall we say, extensive and extensively different than the way it treated men. In the second half of the show, we're able to talk about women who make it to the top or the top two slots on the ticket, national ticket, vice president and president. And I was fascinated to read, of course, that Margaret Trace Smith actually received a presidential nomination at a major party's convention after the war. This, to me, this seems to be an absolutely amazing innovation.
Yeah, so she was placed in nomination. Of course, Barry Goldwater ended up getting it. But what's interesting about Margaret Trace Smith and her story is that she ended up getting into Congress like women did in those early days, mm-hmm. due to the death of her husband. So for a lot of women, they were placed in there as a, so to speak, seat filler until right. the party could find somebody else to take the slot. But Margaret Chase Smith ended up staying in Congress and had a pretty successful career there. And she ended up having a career somewhat similar to Lyndon Johnson's in the fact that they were in the House and the Senate. And what's interesting about Margaret Chase Smith is that she decided to run, I think, because she felt that she should, because so many women had come before her. She had intended to run against Kennedy, not against Lyndon Johnson, right, of course, when she decided to run. But one of the things that's so interesting about her coverage is you see a lot of the same themes that came up before with the prior women. But with Margaret Chase Smith, you see criticism about her age.
Ah.
And so this is another significant problem that women in politics face, is that if you are young, it is assumed that you should be home with your family. Women today continue to get asked questions when they're out campaigning or they're in office, you know, well, who's taking care of your children? These are questions that male politicians are not asked.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. But in her case, she was considered too old.
Right.
Yeah. So you're too young or you're too old and you should just stay home and knit and do quiet activities, right? So for women, it's you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. No matter what you do, it's wrong, right? You can't win. And so she received criticism about her age. There was numerous press stories that referred to her as a white-haired widow. That made her sound extremely elderly, even though this was a very active, energetic woman. So it was extremely misleading to do that. And then you also have what's referred to as the masculine-feminine double bind. And this is most easily explained in the context of Hillary Clinton, where if you come out as too powerful, then you are considered to be, so to speak, too masculine as a woman. This is when we tend to be labeled as a bitch, right? If you're too powerful. So then you try to overcompensate and show that you are feminine, and then you release a cookie recipe. And then you get rid of, right? It's like no matter what we do as women who are smart and strong and educated, we get criticized for it. So an example of what happened with Margaret Chase Smith is this is probably the best thing. She was an acknowledged defense expert, having toured overseas defense posts, also is a great lover of flowers.
Well, really?
This is actual press coverage of her. So this highlights the masculine-feminine double bind, right? So she's a defense expert, but that's a little too powerful, so we got to bring her down a notch and make sure we say that she loves flowers.
Yeah.
Now, Lyndon Johnson also was on, you know, these same kind of committees. And Lady Bird was into the flowers, but do you think anybody would have written that about Lyndon Johnson?
No, of course not. Yeah.
No. And so you still see this sexist coverage playing out in the same kinds of patterns during this race as well.
Now, why did she, apart from what you might say the obvious reasons, she doesn't get the nomination in 64 and Goldwater does? Is the nomination, the fact that she's placed a nomination at the convention just sort of a publicity stunt, or is it seen as a publicity stunt by people, or is this a sincere effort?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. But I mean, the thing with Margaret Chase Smith is that she really didn't campaign as much as, like, say, Jeanette Rankin did in her state, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Margaret Chase Smith was still very focused on her role in the Senate. You know, stories pointed out that she didn't have like a strong campaign apparatus around her as far as fundraising and staffing and all of that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as strong as an effort. You had the press criticizing her again with some gendered language here. They described her as a woman without a chance who drove quietly about by a private car, like a favorite aunt calling on relatives.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is another, I call this chapter media negligence of Margaret Chase Smith. But she also could have put more effort into her campaign.
Well, then we go further later into 20th century, and we have Geraldine Ferraro, who gets the Democratic nomination for vice president in 1984.
Yeah, and I didn't end up including her in my book for a few reasons. One, I had come across some research that had looked at the sexism of her campaign, and I was interested more so in covering women who hadn't been studied as extensively.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so I didn't just want to repeat what had already been done. But I ended up finding out later that there hadn't nearly been enough of an in-depth analysis done on her as I initially thought. And so now I wish that I had gone into more depth on that. The other reason that I didn't select her is because, as I said at the beginning, I was trying to look at women in, you know, 45-ish year periods to be able to go across right. time in a right. kind of consistent way. And so, and I knew that I wanted to come up to the present. And so that's why I ended up jumping from Margaret Chase Smith to Sarah Palin. Now, initially, my book chapter was going to be about Nancy Pelosi, not about Sarah Palin.
Right, okay.
But I ended up changing topics because the Speaker of the House is selected by members of Congress itself, not really by the people directly. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up deciding it wasn't enough of an apples to apples comparison with the other women I had looked at. And because so much has been done about Hillary Clinton and the sexism that she has faced, that's how I ultimately ended up with Sarah Palin.
Well, let's talk about Sarah Palin. It was certainly one of the most interesting campaigns in my lifetime. And certainly I can't remember any more sort of fun being poked at a candidate than Sarah Palin. But there was a lot more to her press coverage than that, as you point out in the book.
That campaign, again, the historical context of everything matters so much. Mm-hmm. And so with that campaign in particular, you had a number of factors that contributed to the sort of wild coverage that she received. Number one, it was a wide open race.
Right.
So it wasn't a president or a vice president running. This was a wide open race.
Right. No incumbent.
Made
yeah.
it a little, you know, added a little more craze to it. Number two, very turbulent time in general, especially with the media, because this is the start of the recession. We, at this time, were losing classified advertising in droves. Advertising revenue was going down.
Mm-hmm.
The internet was becoming, and web traffic was an increasingly important part. I was working as a journalist at this time, where it seemed to be very important to get web clicks, to read our stories, to be able to show to advertisers why they should advertise with us. So this is a very stressful time in the media industry as well.
Right.
From more of kind of a pop culture perspective, reality television is taking off. We're really, nothing is off limits with what you share about other people and what you put on television. Right,
right.
And then, of course, we're in the post-Watergate era where you have the journalism industry taking much more seriously its role to vet candidates and make sure that the public knows exactly who they're voting for. So all of these factors coming together made for a very wild election and coverage that could have been much better, quite frankly.
Well, I think everyone will probably remember, you know, the Saturday Night Live thing. And everyone will remember, I can't remember, a number of important CNN commentators and people going on saying, you know, she doesn't know anything. We can't have this person as a second in line, you know. What other types of press coverage was there? I mean, I don't remember any positive press coverage, even though there must have been, certainly from the conservative or Republican media.
Sure there was. And I mean, I didn't look at biased media. I only looked at the mainstream press coverage. And she was referred to as a rising star on the right, mm-hmm. Which was positive. So she did have some of it. One of the things I think, though, that was frustrating when I was looking at the coverage and when I think about American opinions in general on her. Now, I haven't done extensive coverage on the prior vice presidents we've had in this country, but believe you me, we've had some clunkers.
Oh, yeah.
And so what was really problematic is that no one really did an analysis of just how qualified were prior vice presidents that we've had in this country.
Well, we've had a lot of clunkers, and an awful lot of clunkers relatively recently. Dan Quayle and Spiro Agnew and, you know,
yes,
and on and on, yes. And on and on and on
and on. And this context was completely missing. Now, I don't get into partisan discussions about Sarah Palin. This is why I don't like dealing with recent history and like dealing with the past, is because people are still too up in arms and not willing or able to think like clearly about these issues. So the Sarah Palin portion of my talk is always what most people want to talk about.
Yeah.
But I mean, just stepping back again, I think no matter how you feel about Sarah Palin, you need to acknowledge that her coverage was number one, sexist that she received, and number two, not put into context of how she compared to prior vice presidential candidates.
Right.
To give people a better understanding of that. Now, the most interesting finding that I had, and this kind of like saved the whole book and gives us some hope, right? Is what was interesting about 2008 is you have Sarah Palin running and you have Hillary Clinton running. So you have both of the political parties dealing with massive, ugly sexism and realizing this is a significant problem for them.
Yeah, we should remind buzzkillers that Hillary Clinton's running in the Democratic primary against Obama, and then Sarah Palin is actually then chosen as the VP nominee by McCain.
Exactly. So you have Hillary Clinton coming off sexist coverage, and then you have Sarah Palin diving, you know, right back into that same wave of sexist coverage. And so there's a quote, you know, "I will not stand by while Sarah Palin is subjected to sexist attacks." And so you start to see finally this awareness that had been lacking previously. So I want to just go back real briefly to Margaret Chase Smith, because I think this is important and goes to my point about complete lack of context or history in American education and mindsets. A quote from Margaret Chase Smith's coverage, this is 1964. Somebody who was a school board president said this: "More power to her, someone had to start it," as in a woman running for president.
Right.
And this is the problem that we have, is this lack of historical knowledge among the general public. Margaret Chase Smith was not the first woman to start it. You can go back to the suffragists in 1840. You can go back to Victoria Woodhull in 1872. We have a long history of women being active in politics and trying to make a difference. But now here's my gripe right here. Okay, everybody's heard me gripe about K-12 history textbooks and how much I hate them.
Yeah, this is elementary school textbooks.
Okay. Again, who writes history textbooks? Who's being included? Who isn't? You might get Eleanor Roosevelt, Susan B. Anthony, you know, a couple of those women sprinkled throughout your textbooks. But how much of women's history are we really learning in school? Certainly they weren't learning anything back in the 1960s, apparently, about the history of women in politics. And by not having this history in this context, it makes it seem like women running for office is completely a novelty, right? And when something's a novelty, that's not a sure thing, and it makes us uneasy. And so by having this lack of context and this continued sexist coverage, women in politics know. So this is a clip that's from that sexist table coverage, you know? Well, if women are, you know, such a big majority of the country, why aren't there more women in office?
Right.
Well,
right.
It's because women know. Women know that they have this extra hurdle that they have to overcome that men don't, to be deemed legitimate by voters. And this continues. This continues after more than a century of women involved in politics. And so that's why I go around talking about my book, to try to educate people to think more about your own unconscious bias when it comes to women in politics and who you are choosing to represent you.
Well, then how do you, the book obviously sort of ends with Sarah Palin and then your general analysis, but having gone through these case studies, how did the treatment of Hillary Clinton during the election of 2016 seem to be either different or similar or worse or better than the treatment of these other women previously?
Both with Hillary Clinton in 16 and Hillary Clinton in 08 and Sarah Palin in 08, you see the exact same media vilification frame that was given to Victoria Woodhull in 1872.
Right.
The same framing is happening.
Yeah.
And the thing with Hillary Clinton is that she had a much longer record, right? We could go back to the 90s when we had a little more of an entrenched sexism than we even do today.
Right.
With, again, this is a woman who was extremely educated and was trying to get involved with policy And people wanted to shove her back. And I also study press coverage of first ladies. All of this combines, right? What is the role of a first lady in this nation if you're just supposed to give teas and socials and look pretty, right? People were up in arms about having a powerful first lady, which again shows a lack of historical context. Sure. We can go back to Sarah Polk, who was essentially almost a co-president with James Polk. When she died in the 1890s, the press full out admitted that. Nobody seemed to have a problem with that back in like the 1800s. But yet it's a problem now if a first lady tries to be powerful and get involved with politics, which is very strange. So again, this all boils down to a lack of knowledge of history. And so, yeah, I mean, Hillary Clinton, the satanic ticket, right? Those same kind of things from Victoria Woodhull, which is just very disappointing that we have not made more gains in American understanding of sexism in that time. I mean, certainly the fact that she won the popular vote shows that there is more awareness for this. But, you know, even now in this election cycle with Kamala Harris, and then you have the extra element of race included, right? She's been referred to as angry, as a monster, therefore trying to tie it to the angry black woman stereotype that exists throughout our country and the underlying bigotry and racism that ties into that. But with Kamala Harris, you also see, you know, connections with like Jeanette Rankin, right? Where an entire article was written about Kamala Harris's shoes. Like, I don't remember ever reading an article about Mike Pence and his shoes or Joe Biden when he was vice president and what shoes he wore. And so these are just very strange choices that continue to be made that give women completely different coverage and understanding in American voters' minds than male candidates.
Okay, then how do you think this will inform your future research? Are you going to continue along these veins? After all, this is going to continue to happen. We hope it'll continue. I mean, I don't mean the bad treatment. I mean the women running for the top ticket. Do you see yourself working on this more and more and more as the decades roll on?
My next book is likely going to focus on the first ladies who weren't wives.
I
think that so much in recent history, we are so used to a female spouse performing this role, when actually it was very common in the early days of our country for a sister or a niece or somebody like that to perform this role. And the reason that I want to do that is because we are going to finally get to a point in this country where we do have a woman president. Or a so to speak, first lady who isn't a lady. And I want to be able to provide historical context that we've had it happen before where this position was not held by a wife and we made it out okay, because I expect there has been already some coverage of Kamala Harris's husband, you know, and, you know, being the second gentleman, right? People are fascinated with that. So I want to try to like bring it back down to earth for when we do have a different type of first lady, so to speak, of here's historical context on how this happened and played out before. Now, granted, it wasn't a man, of course. It was still in those times a woman performing that role, but still it was different. And it raises the question that is even coming up today, is it fair to require the wife, or the spouse, I should say, the spouse of a president to perform this role in the first place?
We're seeing with Melania Trump
that she's not overly interested personally in doing these kind of roles, or, you know, things that the first lady has done historically. Michelle Obama, very successful career woman, right? I mean, she could have potentially continued working in her career, doing her own thing, right? But she didn't. She decided to perform the office as it had been historically. But this is a position that isn't paid.
We don't pay
these people a dime to do all of the work that they do. So is this a position that should be a professionally paid position by somebody who is actually well qualified and wants to do state dinners and all of these kinds of things? Or do we keep requiring the spouse to do this, even though that may not be their interest area? So I know that this is a little maybe out there for your listeners to consider this
because it's
not really made the mainstream before to have these kinds of discussions. But I'm going to drop that right there because I do see perhaps in the decades to come, this position shifting.
Absolutely. I think it'll change dramatically. All sorts of things may change with gender roles and people with different sexuality eventually being elected to president. And it'll be very interesting to see how all those dynamics change. Well, the other thing that's been extremely interesting, Professor, is having you on the show. This has opened up so much context for our listeners. It's very, it deals with the just election that we just had, and it deals with how we can think about things happening in the future. And I hope you'll come back on the show to talk about this new book when it's finished.
Sure, I'd love to. I do a lot of different things.
Okay. Thank you again. We'll just say to all the buzzkillers out there that we will talk to you next week.